Welcome to our industry leaders series, Growing Beyond. Today, we're talking to Nick Tobain, who is the National Managing Partner for Grey Putson. Now, Nick has a very interesting history and also works across the entire market. This is an exceptionally interesting discussion, and I highly encourage you to have a good listen to this. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to be starting a new series on industry leaders calling Growing Beyond. We have Nick Tobain here today, who is the Managing Director of Grey Putson. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Seton. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Nick, let's be honest for those who are listening, and you and I have obviously known each other. I have obviously worked with Grey Putson before, but we're going to go through a bit of a history of things.
So, Seton, Grey Putson was founded in March 1991, so coming up to 35-year birthday.
Wow.
Started in Melbourne by Peter Gray and Robert Putson, and has over the last 34 and a bit years grown to have studios in Sydney, Brisbane, Canberra and Melbourne. So yeah, the firm has evolved very much in that time, actually.
Absolutely. And obviously, you know, it's grown across multiple regions, multiple sectors. So tell us a little bit about the sectors that you're working in as well.
Yeah, so sector-wise, traditionally, we've done a lot of commercial work. We do a lot of education work, a lot of workplace and interior design, interior architecture. That's been a big part of our growth. We do some, over the last 5 to 7 years, we've done a fair bit of health work as well. We've become quite specialised in the health sector. Mm. And of recent time, quite a few hotels. We've got 3 or 4 hotels in the books now.
Fantastic.
And are very much working our way into the living sector, rather belatedly, but it's, you know, we've come to realise that it's an area where our staff want to work and our staff are excited by. Everyone gets excited by nice dwellings, nice apartments, nice hotels. And apart from the fact that there's a need for more accommodation in Australia, it's something that our staff like to do.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think, Ben, you're actually touching on pretty much every way that someone lives. You know, we know all that architects want to do is to, you know, create change and to be able to help people and shape the environments around them. So you help them by through the education stage, you now help them even where they're living, where they're working. And I know you're also expanding your seniors living sector as well. So even as we go through all stages and even in the hardest parts of our life and health. So it's pretty impressive. I'd say there's not very many firms who probably touch on as many sectors unless they've expanded. So well done. And I think that's a great recognition in obviously your ethos. So tell us a little bit, you guys started actually more from the interiors side of things, didn't you? And have expanded.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, it's expanded. When the practice was founded in 91, it was in the middle of the early 90s recession here in Australia. Refurbishing small office buildings and doing small fit out work was really all that was there. So the organization sort of developed this expertise, because that's all there was. And it's a lot of churn work. Funnily enough, 91 was when I finished university, and it was that bad. I actually left the country to go work overseas for 3 years to live in Hong Kong. And I didn't know Pete and Rob, but, you know, there wasn't a lot there. That's how the interiors work really started. And it's sort of grown from there. And we've sort of grown, like I said, into bigger commercial work, bigger workplace work. Yes, and the education work, we really put in sort of social infrastructure, and that really started in sort of fire stations and community pavilions with councils, and then that grew into education and schools.
Yeah,
it's something it's been an interesting journey, actually. It's been really
positive. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really important thing, actually, out of Grey Putson's story. I was having a conversation with somebody the other day and said, oh, it's really hard to get from the interiors to the architecture side. And I mean, you are architects at the end of the day, but the interiors is always a really important part. And you'll find that in all large firms. They'll have that really big mix between interiors and the architecture side of things. But I think that your story has also always been about shaping from the interiors outside. So looking at how people are going to be using the space and what you're doing, thinking about who is using this, what impact are we having on their lives and how are we approaching it with that. And I think that comes from a different perspective than just, you know, people who try and create buildings to make them look pretty and then try and build the interiors to make it suit around that. And that was one of the early things you and I spoke about. You've got to be thinking about it from the inside out. So let's talk about your journey. So you talked about that. So can I ask you, why did you study architecture in the first place?
Good question. I had an uncle who was an architect. Through my schooling, look, I was a little bit of a science nerd. I liked maths and I liked physics and I liked chemistry and those things. But I actually always did graphic design as one of my subjects, which I think is called VCD now in school, so visual communication design. So all through my schooling up until my final year 12, I studied graphic design all the way through and thought, well, the uncle who was the architect, I thought, was my coolest uncle. And so I think that had a lot to do with it. I was 17 years old when I actually made this life choice. And it's bizarre that I love what I do. I'm one of the very lucky ones in the world. I genuinely love my job. But I made that decision at 17. So I think that was more good luck than good management. I was flirting with engineering, but this sounds like a really horrible thing to say because my oldest son's an engineer, but I just thought I wanted something a bit cooler, and architecture provided that opportunity to me. So when you're 17 years old and a little bit shallow, 17-year-old boy even actually, a little bit more shallow than a 17-year-old female, it was a little bit cooler. So that's honestly how I ended up in architecture.
It's quite funny, Nick. I ask this question. It's the first question I ask whenever I do an interview. Okay. And the reason being is it will generally give us a really good insight into the person and what it was. The answer you've given is actually very, very similar to a lot of people, where it's like this mix between the science and the art.
Mm.
What about engineering? But it's just too, it's, I can use my language, not theirs, straight laced. So it's not an unusual story. The cool uncle does come into it, though. I can totally see how that totally comes with you, though. Absolutely. And I think you are the cool uncle, too. Because, I mean, now you think about that, your children have all just finished school as well. The third one's just finished. How do you kind of look at them and go, you know, do you think you're going to be doing the same profession for the, how many years are we going now? My mathematics is going to be sharp. 35 years. What did we just talk about?
Yes.
Do you think they'll be having the same, or do you think they'll be evolving their careers throughout that time as well?
I think it's a little bit different now. I think it's a little bit different now from what I can see. They'll be evolving their careers. I guess two of my three have done, are doing professional degrees and one hasn't. It'll be a variation of the theme, but staying in the one career. And you know, many, many architects I know, people that graduated didn't complete the course or either didn't complete the course or changed careers halfway through. And that's something that I think will become more and more common as we move on. I don't know for fact, but my gut is telling me that.
And I think we'll talk about this as we go through and we can link that a bit to your journey as well. I think that, you know, for architects, you're quite lucky. You learn to be thinking in big thinking, right? I always find architects, I love working with architects because they've kind of got the right and the left brain, if you want to put it in those terms of the creativity, but then the ability to detail and think something through to the minutiae level. But also then you've got to have the personal skills as well to be able to, at the end of the day, it's a team sport, right? Not just interning collaboratively, but working on projects. And you're generally the person who's, depending on what the nature of the contract is, but you're the person who's actually trying to get the vision and make sure that the vision is actually achieved at the end of the day. And I do actually remember you saying, you know, our job, and I don't want to quote you, so please correct me, but our jobs as architects is to sell something that the concept or something other people can't see. What was that you've said? Or I probably just
I don't recall that saying that, but that is our job. We've got to convince our clients that what we're providing them design-wise is going to, you know, meet and exceed their demands.
Yeah.
Demands is not the right word, but their brief and what they're trying to achieve.
Mm.
Architects, what about architects? I think a lot of us are all on the spectrum and we try and work things over and over and over to get what we want to achieve. And, you know, you put your personal overlay on that no matter how much you say that it's you don't want to, but of course you do. For me personally, it's about, you know, I'm a people person, and everything that from a design point of view, when I'm assessing something or trying to design something, is about how will people feel in that space.
Yeah.
And that's all I care about. It's the actual human emotion of when we're designing a space, is even, you know, to the things that people touch. You know, the way you feel a wall, if a wall feels, you know, a bit cold and a bit clinical, a bit shiny, people are less comfortable. There's a place for that, obviously. But you know, the textures you choose, the colours you choose, and if people feel uncomfortable in the space, unless that's what you want to do, but that's your brief. You want to make people feel uncomfortable, then I think you've sort of failed. That's my big passion, is how people feel in the space.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's very much what we talked about, from that interiors to building the building inside out, and making sure it can be used. I mean, I'm at the other side though, Nick. I mean, you work in the commercial sector, and that is just as much about making sure it adds up. At the end of the day, the building can't be built unless you can actually commercially make it stack up. And that feeling that people have is, you know, particularly today, people wanting to get people back into the workplace. I mean, we're getting to workplace more than just simply commercial, but how you're designing buildings that people want to go back into and interact and you know, then creating the culture that be able to, you know, facilitate those things as well. All right. Well, so let's talk about it. So you started off as a graduate, then you went to in the middle of a recession. I think this is a great point too, because I think a lot of people forget how hard it can. Yes, exactly. People very much forget that, I think, and it is really hard because you can watch the cycles. I mean, how long have I been doing architecture with you guys? Like 8+ years, right? Mm. You watch the cycles within it, and it's hard because if you graduate in a certain year, there was a large demand. But if you if you graduate in 2020 or you graduate in 2021, you would have had two very different experiences.
Yeah, very much so.
Right? And then that can be the start of people's careers, but at the same time, it doesn't also have to define your career as well. And I always believe people need to take control of their own lives and determine their own destiny as much. You know, the moment you give that somebody else, that's when you'll start feeling miserable. Mm. You know, and you won't be actually pursuing where you want to go. So let's talk about that. So tell me a bit about your story.
Yes. I finished at the end of 91, hit the workforce in 92, got some work, but as you were in those days, I worked for free for the first 6 weeks, believe it or not.
Wow. And can't get away with that in Australia today.
No, absolutely not. But on the basis that I'd work half time on projects and half time to teach myself computer skills.
Yeah.
So I spent 20 hours a week teaching CAD as it was then. Now it would be Revit. And then the other 20 hours a week, I was working on build at the time. That was a deal for the first 6 to 8 weeks. And then I went to the enormous salary of $300 a week, so $15,000 a year. And during university, it was pretty bad. And I almost tripled that in my work experience year in the boom times. So in 89, which I worked in my year out, I was earning triple that salary. As an undergrad, right? So I was working in bars. I worked as a cocktail barman, earning double the hourly rate.
I reckon you'd be great at that job.
But it taught me about customer service and client experience. Yeah. And I was dealing with people every day. So in the end, I figured, okay, I've been at uni for 5 years with a year out, so 6 years, and I'm earning double the rate as a barman. I always knew that if I failed as an architect, I was a pretty bloody good barman. I reckon I was all right with that. In the end, I just ended up going to live in Hong Kong, where a whole lot of people from my year and year below me went to live in Hong Kong. It would have been 15 or 20 of us from Melbourne Uni, where I studied, living in Hong Kong, working in Hong Kong.
Was it great? Because Hong Kong in those days would have been amazing.
I had a fantastic time. I worked pretty hard, played pretty hard, learned a lot, saved some money. The weird thing is there was so much work, and bearing in mind I'd had 10 years postgrad experience, worked for 10 months. I'd been working for 10 months. I landed at 2 o'clock on a Tuesday, and I had two job offers by lunchtime Wednesday.
Yeah.
And it was literally, they just wanted warm bodies. There was that much work. So Hong Kong was like the Middle East is today.
Yeah.
So I worked there.
Well, I mean, I think it's a good, whether you're thinking on international scale or local scale, at the end of the day, there are markets, right? Yeah. And different things have different times. But I think that's what people forget. Like we will have the same, you know, I remember post GFC or a bit when there was a downturn in Europe or in the UK or in Ireland, you would obviously get a lot of people coming across and there was a lot more opportunities. And I think that's what this is the great thing. You're very, very lucky as an architect. You can literally go anywhere in the world.
Yeah, correct.
Right? And you can literally do anything. And I think there's fantastic experiences that people can have. Amazing, like how great is it? You get to try out a whole new culture and do that, but you also get to get exposure to work and different ways of working as well. And I think it's the same, you know, I think we make it very hard in Australia to come here and do that. So it's a lot harder. But I think that if people are struggling, don't just think within, particularly if you're younger, you don't have a mortgage, you don't have kids, everything like that. Like, that's probably my biggest regret is not doing it. I just never wanted to go over to Europe and it was too bloody cold. I now live in Queensland because it's too bloody cold in Melbourne. But I completely advocate for that. So you came back from Hong Kong. So tell us.
Yeah, so I came back. I got to the point where 3 years and I've still got really good friends from uni who still live there.
Including your wife as well, I think.
I met my wife in Hong Kong. Yes, she had done the same from London. She grew up in London and same thing. There wasn't a lot of work and the recession was pretty much through the Western world. And
yeah, right.
If that's the right analogy, turn the use. So she was in Hong Kong as well and that's how we met. But I got to the point where it's either come home or make it my home. And, you know, there's still a fair chunk of my heart still there.
I could see you being an expat.
Yeah. Oh, I wasn't living the expat life. I was just living the local life. There was none of the expat perks. So decided to come home and had a couple of interviews. And the second interview I had was with Peter Graham, Rob Puxhand. And next month will be my 30th year at Great Puxhand. So,
so how big was GP when you joined?
I was employee number 12.
Number 12. Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
And they'd only just opened Sydney, and that was only just opened Sydney, and then obviously in Melbourne, and then So onwards and upwards. And I seem to have something that they wanted, and they certainly had something I wanted.
So it's that barman skills, isn't it? Really?
There's those barman skills.
Honestly, we'll get to that as we go through. All right. So you then do that. So tell us a little bit about how, I mean, because your evolution is also linked to Gray Putzen's evolution as well.
Yes, absolutely.
So talk to me a little bit about, and I think it's a great story as well, because people often think that, oh, I've got to go and join the big firms and do all of this stuff. And there's absolutely, you're going to get larger exposure to projects and things like that. But there is also an evolution of firms. You know, there's very, very few firms who have made it through multiple generations. We generally get to this, you know, they don't succession plan right, or they don't, you know, I think Gray Putzen has a great strategy and diversify enough that you've got that to balance things out. And that's not what all firms do. There's other sides where you can niche, and that's fantastic, but it's going to go down at times when that sector's not going or that region's not doing great. But I think there is a part there of a really good part when somebody actually does join an organization and can evolve with it. And I think that evolution is two things. It is on the company and the leaders who are in the company, but it's also on the person as well. Right. And I think that's a little bit of your story. I mean, there's multiple partners, if you can, you know, have to mention names, but how many of you sort of grew up from that and still exist within the business? And then you've gone through the next evolution or two evolutions with having the people come in. So tell us sort of a little bit about, give us a summary.
I think Gray Putzen's reasonably unique for a firm of its age. I mean, there's firms that have been around, obviously, over 100 years, there's a few in Australia who've got the cycle right, and they're still around, and there's a reason they're still around. So I think when Pete and Rob started the business, and Pete left us almost 20 years ago now, but when they started the business, it was, I don't think they ever saw it as a vehicle for their own egos and their own architectural pursuits. They always saw it as they wanted something that will evolve and continue to evolve, and that's always been number one priority, is that, you know, I know Rob Puxhand very much believe, you know, I think what would make him most happiest in 30 years' time, which he might still be around, as in...
I know. It's not that old.
This mortal coil is that Gray Puxhand thriving and strong, you know, and it's very much the same with me. And you know, if the organisation, you know, thrive, we're setting it up to hopefully thrive in the future. And that's because we want to be doing good things and designing good buildings and good spaces for people, and that we can continue to do so. And we've always tried to encourage our team members to get involved in the organisational structure and understanding. And at the end of the day, you can be designing amazing buildings, but if you don't have any clients, you could be the greatest designer in the world, but if you don't have any clients to design buildings for, it'll all be, you know, hypothetical and nothing will get built. So we spend our time encouraging people to understand that without our clients and our clients being happy, we won't have any projects to work on. Yeah. And what we want to do is do good projects ultimately and keep our clients happy, you know, and hopefully, you know, make a buck and feed our family along the way and pay off our mortgage and other things too. It's all those sorts of things.
Well, I mean, I think this is where I do have a slight insight. So we're having a little bit more of an equal discussion than a full questions. But I think one of the things I remember Robert always saying, you need to have a successful business to do good design. And I think that's fundamental. There's a lot of firms out there who are all about doing, you know, the sexy or even emerging, and they want to go all for that. At the end of the day, if you don't manage it, and I mean, the business of architecture is also very difficult to do too, with cash flow and managing your pipeline and doing all that. It is true. If you don't have that, then you can't pay your staff. Right. You can't do all of those things. You can't look after people. And if you don't do that, then that slowly starts to, you know, if you can't pay people, you can work for the best designer ever, but if you're not getting your pay packet, it's not going to really make.
And there's plenty of stories. There's plenty of stories that are going on. And I know there's plenty of historical stories. It's a lot harder now, but it's some things that people got away with previously.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was a recent architectural review piece talking about the business of architecture and how architects are their own worst enemies that act. And my university education was like this, where financial naivety is seen as a sign of purity, and people, they want to be seen as pure. At the end of the day, that doesn't make for successful architectural outcomes because everyone's basically work. And the work gets devalued and people get less respected.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually a fascinating piece, so I recommend that you...
Oh, no, please do. I think everybody... Look, I mean, I do love architects. I can't say they're out of all the professions that we work out, they are the best with the business and numbers side of things. They definitely... But at the end of the day, though, it's like anything, right? If you've got strengths, you've got to find other people that also plug into those strengths and those weaknesses too. And I think that's, you know, you and I have had conversations over the years of also what that balancing is within a team, what you need, you know, and we'll talk about that, the different roles that different people play or different strengths that people play. And, you know, you might have the fantastic designer, you've got the great business person or hustler, which, you know, we'll talk about your skill set and things like that, you know, and then obviously you need the technical or that. Now, that can be in one person if you're establishing and it's in a group or it's hiring somebody, knowing what your weaknesses are. I mean, at the end of the day, the business thing's actually the easiest thing to do. You just get a bloody good bookkeeper or accountant and just make sure you're accountable to them and they keep telling you the information you need and you keep that in mind, right? Love it when I simplify things. But
no, you're right. But you're not wrong.
Yeah, exactly right. Right. You can't be everything, and you've got to know your weaknesses as much as you know your strengths. And I think that's one of the things. So let's talk about that as well within your evolution of how you've gone. You are the managing partner. I keep saying director, managing partner at present. Previously, you've obviously been the state managing partner, but, you know, the role that you've sort of found that you've played in your area, not just in Grey Parkson, but also within the industry and knowing yourself and how that's evolved.
It's part of it is understanding, as you said, what you're good at and accepting what you're good at. How to describe this? I'm not without self-belief, but I'm humble enough to know when there's people better at me at certain things, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a workmanlike, I'd call myself a workmanlike designer. There are people that can design better than me. I'm technically pretty sound, but I know there are people that have forgotten more technical things than I'll ever know. But it's just understanding where you sit in that piece, because there's so many different elements to architecture that people need to, you know, fulfill. It's rare that you'll find a triple threat that can just do everything, right? It's very, very rare. And they do exist, but
they're not
hard to find. So,
well, at the end of the day, you know, one person can't do everything.
I think a lot of that's ego-driven because people think that they can. That's my personal view. Like I said, self-esteem is important, but too much self-esteem can be a downfall. It's a personal view of mine. But there's plenty of architects that have a very high self-esteem.
Well, I think the people who run the best businesses are the people who realize that they're actually their job is to figure out, to find people who are better at everything than they do.
Yeah, correct.
And to be better at all their weaknesses, even their strengths. And then you've got this amazing, incredible team that, you know, you're leading and directing and making sure the ethos of your approach is continued on.
And one of the things I learned from my bosses in Hong Kong was about very much that, you know, we're a service industry. And yes, we're designing buildings for outcomes that impact the urban realm and impact the way people feel.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, we're paid for by our clients. So we need to give them the result that they want and that they need and they commission us to do. So, and it's one thing I enjoy doing. As I said before, I like people. So I realized soon enough that people seem to like me sometimes. So I could make a point of actually going to see people and talk to them about what we do and how we operate and then delivering on it. My personal journey is I don't like letting people down. And so I make it, and I'll always make sure that I'll deliver when I can, deliver the design outcome that we can and the project timeline that we can.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what I pursued. I like being around people, so I went and spent time and became an expert in a couple of things. And I focused commercially primarily. That's through necessity. I'm swatting up on a lot of living sector now to become a bit of an expert there, but as much as I can, but until that market picks up. But at the end of the day, people need to trust you, and if people are going to refer you to someone else, they'll only do that if they have your trust. If they're the other way around, you know what I'm trying to say. You won't let them down. So if someone's going to refer Nick from Grey Parkson to a client, they know that I'm going to deliver.
Yeah, you're going to do it.
Otherwise. Yeah. And that's the hardest bit. And once you've got their trust, life gets a lot easier. In terms of knocking on doors and trying to win projects.
Absolutely. And I think you've identified something. It is, at the end of the day, it is all service, right? So the entire industry, whether you're a builder, whether you're an architect, whether you're an engineer, there's the technical element of it. But at the end of the day, there needs to be a project, needs to be within a budget. If it's, you know, even if it's in early stages, what can we actually build? What is possible? You know, as the experts, you're being paid to give that opinion.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is not necessarily going into a meeting and spouting about what you do, but actually understanding what the client is looking for. So listening and understanding and doing that, and obviously using your network to understand those things too from other parts, and then just making sure, you know, on the delivery of that. All right, brilliant. That's good. So let's talk a bit about now the industry as well. So what do you see as some of the biggest challenges in the industry?
At the moment, it's obviously the making projects stack up. That'll still be, Australia needs a lot of work done, whether it be accommodation, whether it be infrastructure, whether it be whether it's social infrastructure, hard infrastructure like road and rail, housing for people to live in, sheds for storage and industry, data centers, all those things, hospitals, all those things need to be built, because Australia is a country that's growing with the growing economy. One of the things about Australia that I love is that we have quite an equitable salary base compared to the rest of the world. But the downside of that is that we pay our people fairly compared to a lot of other parts of the world. And I used the word relative there. That makes construction more expensive. And so once construction becomes more expensive, then it gets harder to deliver. So the government has only got limited tax pool that it can draw upon and debt it can take to build things. Developers have to make a profit. It's not, you know.
Well, you won't be doing the next job, project.
They can't get finance. The banks won't give them money for it. So the banks need to be, and the financiers need to understand that there will be a profit. So developers making a profit isn't essential for projects to happen. So at the moment, we're in a little bit of this stalemate at the moment where things are too expensive to build. With the return that's required to make them work, whether it be a social outcome or a health outcome or a profit outcome, all those things. You know.
That's where we're very lucky as a country. And you talk about that, because we'll talk a little bit about, we live in a global world where we have actually resources and we can do that for certain things. But I think it is fantastic in Australia. We have a lot of equality, and that is, we're very, very privileged. If you think about, there's only certain countries, you know, around the world, we have free healthcare, all of those things. But the hard part is that means that labour can get very expensive to actually build. We obviously haven't had, and I'm very interested when we talk about the future of things. You know, trades hasn't been something. You talk about your children, it's like, you know, I would have thought my kids, I was professional, went and did a law degree. It's like, yep, okay, that's what you're going to do.
Yep.
I think that's going to change in the next 20 years. Absolutely.
I think it might too.
And I think it will help for the industry long term. I think in the short term, it's going to be very tough. Obviously, we live very far away. We work in a global economy where we are actually trading goods, and how much it costs to actually get things to this country is something itself. We don't have manufacturing, can't necessarily set the, yes, in small parts, but not to the same size and scale. We haven't specialized in that. But 100%, I think the industry right now is in every single market is the biggest struggle. I mean, I'm obviously based in Queensland. Whilst there is billions of dollars of projects sitting in DA, nobody can make it stack up. And there's only a certain amount of trades. I think we need over 250,000 trades just to build what needs to be built.
In Queensland?
In Queensland
alone. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's a big number that's needed.
And the capabilities of builders who can take on that risk and have the ability to deliver those projects, there's only a few. So if you're putting them on too many projects at once, you're actually now limiting what you can actually do. So it's a very interesting, you know, we won't get into the politics side of things and around unions and those types of influences, but at the end of the day, the costs have gone through the roof with COVID, but they've also gone through the roof. And that's a supply and demand thing too, At the end of the day, there's lots that needs to be built. There is enough people to necessarily build it. I do. It's quite interesting. I would love to interview somebody on what are we thinking in migration from overseas to get these trades? Because there is actually trades all around the globe. We just need to realize that, but we'll steer away from that. So let's talk about some of the other influencing things. Where do you think the industry will be heading in the next 10 years?
This is the design industry we're talking about?
I'm talking about the entire industry, design and also the built environment.
Well, design industry will go through a bit of disruption. I think that's AI will be a disruptor. It won't change things. There's still going to be architects around, and there'll still be plenty of good architects around. What we're talking about, the cost of labour earlier, that will mean that architects and designers will, and actually engineers, and you've seen it with builders already who get their curtain walls from, nearly every curtain wall in Australia comes from China, and that's a cost of labour equation. So architects will end up offshoring a lot of the commoditised type of work, which is the documentation type of work, in order to keep the costs down. And then there'll be a lot of architects who might struggle to find work as a result. But they'll probably end up filling that. Hopefully they'll end up filling some of it. If they find that architect's not for them, they might end up doing some of those roles and filling the roles in to get things built, because they have an inherent knowledge in that. So I think for sure the future will, and we are investing heavily, is not the right word, but we are certainly investing in AI quite a bit and doing quite a bit of research, and we've implemented our own in-house closed-loop AI tool where things are ring-fenced in the organisation. Yeah. We're exploring all ways of delivering design uplifts. So the design's still done by individuals, by just the way we present it, we're finding more efficient ways of working with that. What would have taken, let's use an example, what might have taken in a course of a year enough work to employ 10 people, I think in 10 years' time, it'll employ 6 to 7 people. So the role won't change, but it makes things more efficient. We've certainly, you know, our submission writing's more efficient throughout investment AI. The couple of our fly-throughs and walk-throughs that we're doing have become more efficient by using AI. But the design work is still being driven by the architects, our interior designers in our group, but just the way we present them is being done in a slightly more efficient way, and that'll get more efficient again. So that'll be one big change. And then obviously I think that the fact that just the reality of life is that firms have to start offshoring a little bit some of the output type work, the process and output type of work. It's just a fact.
Most of the large engineering firms have been doing that for years, the architecture firms. And look, at the end of the day, I mean, you can talk about that and you can take a very Australian point of view, or you can look at it that there is billions of people around the world who are just as qualified, may not be able to get into the country, but doesn't mean just because if you were lucky enough to fly here and get a visa and, you know, get a PR status, there's any difference to you sitting in Australia versus you sitting in another country where you're not leaving your whole family and doing that. I mean, we have people leaving droves, and I think people need to understand we're very fortunate in this country, but we also have exceptionally high cost of living. You know, we actually have some of the most expensive housing in the world. We have some of the most expensive, you know, what we pay for clothing does not exist in other countries, but that was actually due to economics and, you know, trying to look after our manufacturing sector for years. In some ways, whilst we do have some, you know, high wages on a global setting, the actual return that we can get can be quite different. And there is a plethora of people around the world who do want to work hard, but it's a different way of managing people, right? And it definitely is an approaching that. So, and it's obviously also a different skill set as well. So I'm quite interested. I mean, as we know, that's going to be the case. AI is going to come in. The thing that we have to consider is, how do we actually teach people the technical skills as they go through?
That's a very good question. So, look, I'm living that, funnily enough, with my eldest, who's a structural engineer. So he wasn't obviously as obsessed as I was about looking cool. The engineers are cool.
Probably just his cool, mate. You didn't have to try.
Probably. Yes, probably. There's a little bit of face-to-face that's needed. So I'm going to sound old and crusty here by saying this, but, you know, nothing beats seeing someone in action and learning from another person how they behave. And I actually do check with my eldest. He's in pretty much every day to his office where he works. And I asked him why, like, genuinely, because I do a lot of office design work and I like to understand why he's there. And he said, it's the only way I learn. So there will be a bit of a skill gap there that people don't, especially if they're not exposed to it, because if a lot of this work gets done offshore, there's going to be a need of self-starting. People are just going to have to learn and spend time if they're lucky enough to get some work, because it might get harder at graduate level, is that they just need to really spend the time and invest the time themselves to try and upskill a little bit, which will then give them opportunity to do some things. But making sure, like, we've in the last 15 months, we've started running an internal training program with our teams. Every month we'll have one of our experts talk to the whole team about what they're good at. And we have it on our internal, on our GP Connect platform, that they've got access to all those videos and can spend time understanding. It's going to be harder. it is going to be harder, but firms are just going to have to invest in training. I can't think of any other way. Firms are just going to have to invest in training to get people to have the technical skills to do it.
And I think it's also, as we talked about, everything's always a two-way street too, right? Mm-hmm. It's about the individual as much as it is about the organisation. So whilst mm-hmm. organisations need to do that and understanding, it is also about the individual making those choices, right? So we know that. I think the best advice you can give to any graduate is make sure you go in, right? Because you just, and don't put your headphones on, right? Mm-hmm. You just need to listen. Now that's hard for somebody like me who needs to focus on headphones on, but you will learn so much more by osmosis and watching and doing that. I mean, I'm not an architect, but I can walk around and look at something else. I do have a true belief that anybody who is intelligent can actually teach themselves anything, right? You got to work to your strengths and do those things. But at the end of the day, we live in a world now that we actually do. It's now what we choose to apply ourselves to actually learn and to be able to evolve in that. And if you want to be the director of a company or a partner of a company, you're going to go through different evolutions. Let's just sort of talk about that as you go through from a graduate to a senior, to an associate, to a director. Tell us how you see that evolving over that as you go in your skill sets and your knowledge.
So my personal view on that one is that obviously you need to spend the first 3 to 5 years building up a sound technical base. That's the most important thing. And then once you've got that, I think the next 5 to 10 should be spent on people skills and understanding and responding. So you have a sound technical robustness to you, for want of a better word, if you're given that exposure. And some firms, you may not be given that exposure. But if you are, you develop those. And then if you learn how to, you know, correspond with people, deal with people, be willing to talk to people, text people, however you want to message them. And then at the end of 10 years, hopefully you'll be running projects all on your own. You'll be able to handle difficult builders, difficult engineers, difficult clients, which is the exception, I should say. Most of the time, it'll be good clients, good engineers, and good builders. But if you've got that breadth of experience, I think it is really important. Then the next bit's going to be, well, how can I, because that work is reliant upon people giving projects to you. And so if you're looking to, if you're genuinely ambitious, and it's a life choice, right? Just enjoying being a really good architect, delivering really good projects, that's fine.
It is fine.
It's absolutely not a problem. But if you are inclined to move into sort of management and sort of hopefully maybe ownership one day of your own practice, the secret sauce is winning work and having clients trust you and being able to present to clients and, I guess, chase work. Because without that work, you can't execute on the things you've been learning on or the people that you work with who love delivering wonderful projects can work with you to be able to do that. So that is building a network, building a group of people that you can talk to and seek advice from. I think not enough people actually think too many people are too proud to say they don't know something. I've never been too proud to call someone and say, hey, I haven't done this. What do you reckon I do? And I don't think clients mind either. They don't expect you to have an answer for everything. But they expect you to go away and research it and come back to them with the right answer a day later, right? So, but knowing the answer on the spot, I mean, I think too many people try and bluff their way through something.
Just
say, no, I'm not sure. Let me go check. I'll ask someone who I work with who knows. So all those things.
Let me think on that. I'll come back to you tomorrow.
Yeah,
it's
not a failure if you don't know everything, right? So I think that's one of the key things. And then people say, okay, well, they didn't try and lie to me. I was going to say something else there, but they didn't try and lie to me.
I think people forget that.
I think that's really important. And they'll build the trust and say, like, they'll not try and lie to me. So, and then, like I said, once clients and then you get a reputation for being good at your work, people, funnily enough, just call. And then when you get out there, they'll chat to you. They'll take your call. Or if you go see them I'm lucky enough, I have a fair bit of front, so I'm happy to go and talk to, I can talk to anyone.
Also not afraid to ask a hard question like that.
Yeah. So all those things that's are right. important. But once you've got, my personal view is you need the technical soundness and the ability to deal with people in a difficult situation. And once you've got that, I think then you can start building a network if that's what you want to do and move your way through the ranks. And then identifying opportunities and be willing to help others, because if you help, so one other thing that I think it's really important that I haven't mentioned is if you're willing to help other people, you'd be amazed how many people are willing to help you.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and that's one of the keys. So I think as long as you're willing to do that and be genuine about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's, yeah. And you know, then you can have a real impact. And, you know, actually I'll digress from it, but one of the things I'm most proud of is certainly a lot of the education work we do. And we've done a lot of schools, TAFEs, university projects, you know, and we've, you know, Grey Pups has genuinely influenced the way kids have been taught in this country, because our spaces are used to teach our future. And we probably don't say that enough to people, you know, and it's,
choose schools with that type of thing in mind, right? Like you kind of.
And then I'm really proud of that, you know. And if we didn't know people who needed schools built, we would never have the opportunity to do that. So,
no, and it's fantastic. We do. And I think that's the thing too, because I mean, obviously, with workplace and with education, with health, there's actually a hell of a lot of stakeholder management. It's actually taking all of that and building it together, taking many voices, and then working. Actually, you know, you can't make everybody happy. That's never going to happen in that situation. But this is the client. This is the person who's paying. This is where everybody who's going to interact with this. How do we actually come out with the right outcome? Who are we keeping in mind for that? All right. So, I mean, I think you've sort of answered some of my questions in regards to, you know, what skills would you, you know, particularly it's quite prominent for your kids, what would you be telling them to focus on for the things they will need to build up? We've talked about the technical. What are the things
I don't know if the correct way to use this word, but the commoditization of the technical work, I think EQ is going to become more and more important. Back to those people skills that I've been talking about, is the ability to just understand, because that's the one thing that won't change, is you know, people need to deal with other people. So if you can read a room, you can understand when a client is needing something, or a client is not happy, or a staff member's not happy, just being able to understand that. The important thing is that, you know, if you aspire to leadership, I think EQ is one of the most important things you can have or having. So I think that's what I'd encourage my kids. One of my kids has it in spades. The other two I need to work on a bit. But so I think
especially in an age now where we're doing a lot of social media or people communicating on things, you know, so it's often that part where sometimes the simplest thing is just pick up the phone. Just pick up the phone, call them.
Yeah,
don't email them. Don't send half an hour, bloody, to pick up the phone. 2 minute conversation. It'll sort it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and it usually will. And the other thing is the downside of the I guess the outsourcing or the modularization, modular construction. It'll take less people, so therefore, purely putting a business hat on, it means architects need to find their fee income from other sources, and those other sources will most likely be at the front end.
Yeah.
Using design, which is what we do, we design, right? And whether it's designing slightly different things or evolving or doing it, whether it's a slightly different disciplines or whether it's into products or whether it's designing things that can be built in modular construction, because the solution to, you know, our labor costs in this country will be modular construction, right?
Yeah.
One of the solutions. So we've got the architects have to find it. And interior designers and graphic designers and industrial designers, product designers, whatever, will need to find ways to, you know, continue to keep their source of fee income and understanding people and what people need and how people respond to what your designer thinks is going to be a really important part of the success of any studio in the future.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's having started a business, that's the entire entrepreneurial thinking, right? It's not what I do. What's the problem that you're actually solving for somebody? And what is somebody, you know, you can turn it into fees or what is it going to be?
Yeah.
But how does that person value that? So it's actually not necessary. So I think 100%, I think the industry will change significantly over the next 10 to 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people skills. And I mean, you know, that's why we start an entire training academy is on that, to actually teach people the most important thing. Yes, it's great from a leadership perspective, but it's also exceptionally important, because what I've always observed, particularly in this industry, is you are dealing with people on a project. And a project can either go very, very smoothly or it can go very awry because you have so many different people trying to do things with different agendas and trying to do that. And yeah. I know that if somebody has the ability, it's how those people work together, whether in their own internal teams or how they're working together on a project team. At the end of the day, we are all going for one outcome, and that is to build to the brief that was given to make sure the space is safe for those who are using it. Have we done our job? Can we put our name to that? And in 30, 40 years' time, it's still sitting there and it's still safe and everything is in that case. And I think that's where we will see the continuous, where the Western world will go is, I believe, is on using our cognitive abilities and making sure that we're optimizing that within our people skills.
Mm-hmm.
Because the world will catch up. It'll be great globally. I think we're going to equalize out a lot more. Mm. But we also have to think as a first world, how do we keep our competitive edge? And that is actually in the brains of these, you know, fantastic creatives and people who actually do. So we have to continue on in what we're thinking.
It's interesting, all designers, especially architects, I remember this from my education, is that, you know, we're taught to think critically and also to solve problems in a slightly different manner. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean we get a better result if it's not necessarily built form design related, architectural related, which we'd like to think we would, given it's our day to day. But sometimes the way an architect approaches a problem can be completely different to the way someone else tries to solve the problem. Absolutely. Or where a client tries to solve that problem. We spent years studying to do that. And I remember, like, we're taught to think differently. That's something that the Western world, that'll need to be a competitive advantage. Because I'd like to think the Western world is slightly leading in that, in the comes to thinking critically. And because our time has become too expensive to deal with the process type work, it needs to be about thinking work. And so I'd like to think architects are pretty well placed to be able to provide ways of doing that. We've just got to find ways to, you know, be able to deliver, convince our clients and, I suppose, monetize it in a funny way as well. We need to be able to get fees to be able to spend time to do it.
Well,
that's something that's important.
I'll sort of end on that in a way that I think I've always had that opinion. I mean, I've got too many pieces of paper, but I always said education is actually just teaches you to think and approach problems in a certain way. But for the law degree, all you learn to do is how to interpret law over and over and over and look at cases and argue something.
Yep.
And I've got an economics degree and the same type of thing. It's how do you approach and look. So you get taught to think in that way. But you think about it, architects go to university for a minimum of 5 years. Everything is about their creative, is all of that. Yeah. How many times have we interviewed graduates? You're like, oh, God, do you actually know how to put a building together? Shit, we're going to have to teach you that. You're going to have to document for the next 2 years to learn that. Whereas now I think, you know, as this involves, no doubt, whilst we're talking about, you know, offshoring, we're also, you know, we know AI will help solve that. At the end of the day, anything that's an arithmetic or has a rules, we have an NCC that's very easy. Let's go to this. We know that. How many people have libraries that are pretty much, you know, general wall sections? And then overlaying that with the knowledge. If you think about it, we kind of teach people at university 5 years to think like that, then we bring them into the workforce and sort of break them to now go and do something methodical. It's not the way their brains were trained for 5 years.
Yeah, true.
Now we're enabling that. You still need to learn the technical elements and understand that, which probably most learned going to site, if we're on it. And then go into detail and check and learn. You can't just outsource to AI and you can't think. You have to critically analyze and not get lazy, which I think is going to be a next 5-year evolution, which will be interesting to watch. But at the end of the day, it's actually bringing in what you learned for 5 years and then the people skills to make it happen. Because at the end of the day, you're not going to be getting architects from another country coming here consulting with and not understanding the way of which business is done. And I work in Queensland. Yep. It's different in every single state, but, you know, you got to understand how things happen around here, right? And I think you'd say the same in Canberra too. It's how things work. Mm. Yeah. So that certainly won't be replaced. I think for architects too, you know, you've got to remember you've stayed in the profession, but as you mentioned, a lot of people change careers. Like, I think it's fabulous when we're talking about the creative side, but from the actual practical side, you know, half the time you'll be losing them to design managers, you know, the other side, or you lose them to project managers if that's the way that their brain works, or, you know, you're even talking advisory now. That understanding of the market and that, like, it's just sort of using it from a different perspective. Instead of I know how to put a building together, is I understand how to get a building built and how that needs to set up and how that needs to be. And I think that's where I think a lot of people in architecture, and it's fantastic because they do it for the love of it. right? Yep. But at the same time, it's probably having that wider mindset of how, what is it that makes me so special that I can do it? And as I said, to begin with, I've always loved architects because they have so much. They just think so differently and they have such a diverse set of skills. Mm. If we look at engineers, most engineers only stay in technical roles for the first 10 years of their lives. And, you know, if you're talking civil,
yeah,
then they're off to be project managers. You never ask an engineer in their 50s, what do you do? Like this one, there is obviously,
crunchy
but
numbers. Yeah,
technical specialists. Correct. Majority of them just do it for a bit and then their careers evolve enormously as they go through things. I'm sure that as a father, as an engineer, you know that's highly likely unless they're going to go and run their own firm as well. So excellent. All right. Well, I think we've had a very interesting discussion. We've definitely gone over time, but I think there's been some great notes in it.
I'll leave you with what I'd like to mention. One thing that just crossed my mind then. This is about architecture. For architects, it's important, right? So if you can actually chart history of countries and history of places through its architecture, because you understand the technologies that were around when things were built. You can understand the political climate as well through the architecture. So every piece of architecture over hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years is very much a reflection of the culture of its time. You know, in 300 years' time or 200 years' time when they're writing the history of this part, certainly in Australia, and the growth in prefabrication, someone will be able to put a piece, a historian will be able to put together saying, oh, labor obviously got too expensive, things got too difficult, therefore they took it off-site in order to build it. You know, in the early 20th century, when you started seeing big bits of glass, you understood that the engineering of glazing developed over time, and all of a sudden the architecture had more glass in it. The reason old traditional buildings have little windows is because that's all they could build, right? And you can actually go through all those things and the engineering feats, understanding how to work with steel, you know, all those things about bigger spans and all those sorts of things. Architecture is important. It's really important.
Like you think about it, people want to go to places that feel good, right? You don't go, oh, I'll go to this place. And like, the architecture makes you feel good and has
it's an important profession. It's a profession that's going to have some disruption, but it's too important a profession. Hang around. It'll hang around very strongly. It just needs to evolve.
It'll just change in the way that
it evolves, as it always.
As it did when CAD came in, as it did when BIMs, you know, they're probably smaller changes. At the end of the day, you know, whatever it is, it's just a tool, right? You know, we talk about AI. That's just a tool to actually achieve an outcome. That tool can now make you be able to produce things quicker, but that's been happening in slower mode for the last few years. This will be a dramatic change, I predict, in the next 5 to 10 years. The next 5 years in particular will be very interesting. But also the technology has to develop and evolve to that.
Correct.
There will also be an evolution of how we approach and use those skills too.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
Even just on that one particular topic, last weekend, Frank Gehry, famous architect, died last week. You know, and he was, his beautiful buildings like the Guggenheim Bilbao and the Disney Center in LA, that couldn't have been possible without computer technology. So, you know, all these little things, AI will have a similar impact. It's just a matter of understanding what, I don't know what that'll be yet, but we're trying to work it out. That was all.
No, absolutely. And I mean, it will be, but at the end of the day, there's a machine does one thing, but it's the people behind it. Correct. And across all professions, this is going to evolve and change enormously. You know, whilst change can always feel scary, at the same time, there's always things that come out of that, right? We all constantly evolve and we constantly keep growing. It's the mindset of taking things on and investing in yourself in and want to continuously develop, right? And we now live in a time where you can't sort of end university and think that's the end of your education. It's probably the start of it.
Yeah, I agree.
And you know, as I said, I think these days we do have an enormous ability to actually learn anything that we want. But with adult learning, it always comes down to the motivators to it, right? So we can give anybody, like instead of student down, but for an adult, we have to always align that to where do you want to go? What do you want to achieve? How do we align that to you wanting to do it? Otherwise, you might as well sit people down and just lecture them for an hour and they tune out and there's no value in return, which is the biggest thing is that they need to have the investment, but it's also for companies to be very clear too. We need this. This is where you need to go. This is your pathway. This is the areas that you need to work on to be your best. But that's a growth mindset, right? It's a growth mindset in the company. It's a growth mindset within an individual of aligning those two things and then facilitating them with the ability in the right way that speaks to them to change that. But we don't need to get on to the whole.
Thanks, Eaton.
Excellent. Thank you, Nick, so much for all your time and for your very insightful and honest truth. Great.
Thank you, Seaton. See you later.
What a great discussion. One of the things I really enjoy talking to Nick about, he's always got his finger on the pulse of where things are and where things are evolving and heading. He's also continuously evolved his career and what role he's played in organisations. And obviously being a father of three and now seeing his next generation come through, there's some fantastic insights into what we need to be focusing on as our skills evolve and the economy changes in the global transition to outsourcing and AI. I hope you enjoyed this fantastic discussion and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode.